Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Imagine sitting across from a friend at a quiet small town bar. It's something a lot of us do or have done at some point in our lives. The local watering hole, the local cheers, the local, hey, let's sit down and talk and be humans and de-stress over a beverage type setting. Venting about work, venting about life, people, experiences. It's nothing unusual. Professors complain about grading students, the oddball teaching assistants who show up late or talk too much. That's, you know, if you're a professor, that's your job. You're going to talk about that with colleagues. You nod, you sip your beer, you laugh. Another day, right? Months later, that same friend walks in with a newspaper in his hand. And his face drained of color. That TA he was talking about, the teaching assistant, the TA stands for. It's the one he'd been calling a douche all semester. Well, he was just arrested for murdering 4 students in Idaho. That's when the ordinary gripe became something darker in a story you wish you hadn't brushed off, but what are you to do? It's a friend blowing off steam. There's nothing you could have done to stop this tragedy, nor could have your friend. And so John Snyder, a longtime public defender turned professor at Washington State University, realized that Brian Koberger, the graduate student assigned to help him teach criminal justice, wasn't just annoying. He was something far worse. And Snyder was not alone. We're going to talk about his experiences here today and what he was telling friends about Koberger prior to everything happening. This is in no way a piece that's, well, if he would have said something more, did no. This is just pure observation of what people were noting about Brian Koberger before the crimes were committed. As documents and interviews continue to emerge, a clearer picture is forming of what it was like to work with Koberger as a teaching assistant. The picture isn't one of brilliance either. It's one of arrogance, control, and the kind of creeping behavior that leaves people unsettled long before anyone calls it dangerous. Snyder's story tells us a lot about Koberger, and it starts in the summer of 2022 when he was randomly assigned Koberger as his assistant. The system used to allow professors to pick from a list, but that semester, assignments were randomized. Snyder remembers the first meeting. Clearly, Koberger was odd, but academia is full of odd people. He didn't see anything alarming at first. Just a graduate student who seemed stiff, overly formal. Didn't take long, though, before the cracks started to show. The problem wasn't just that Koberger missed classes. It was that he found other ways to insert himself, ways that felt less like help and more like harassment. Snyder recalls how at the end of the day, when he was trying to leave, Koberger would appear in the hallway and launch into trivial chatter. He'd follow Snyder down the corridor, nipping at him with pointless stories, refusing to let the conversation end. Snyder started calling it the terrier routine. It wasn't just irritating. It felt like a dominance game, something far beyond just that person that doesn't know when to stop talking. As long as Koberger kept him talking, he was in control. It wasn't only Snyder who noticed. His wife once waited outside in the car only to watch Koberger tailing her husband down the hall. Her gut reaction was immediate. She recoiled to the other side of her seat, unnerved in a way that she couldn't explain. Snyder had never seen her react that way to anyone. Then there were the petty arguments. Koberger once tried to rope Snyder into analyzing how he could beat a parking ticket, even taking him to the lot to examine the scene. Can you imagine going out to the parking lot and there's Brian Koberger with you? Okay. Well, if you were just slightly over the line about this way, then you would have been fine. But you didn't do that. You didn't follow the rules. Like, no, I can only imagine how rigid that conversation would be, how bizarre that conversation would be. Snyder, who had spent decades as a defense attorney, tried to explain that people who think they know the law better than the courts always lose. Koberger, he's not a law student, never was. He was the one taking the law, the person who knew it, who was a defense attorney, who, for a good chunk of life, knew full well how you're going to beat or at least put your best foot forward in a parking ticket to get the least amount of points taken off your license. He would know. Brian Koberger, probably not, considering his multiple visible run-ins with the law. He doesn't seem to know a whole lot about any of these subjects, but he likes to convey to the world that he does. He likes to project. He likes to make you think. And if you think what's behind that curtain is knowledge, is information, is experience, well, then he has you fooled. Just like he liked to make people think he was this serial killer. He was this bad guy. He was this guy who knew the ins and outs, and he was, gosh, he knew his stuff better than Bundy, better than BTK, better than you name the multiple killers that he piecemealed together to come up with an identity and thought he knew better. Yeah. Koberger brushed it off, confident he was smarter than the system. It was the same inflated ego students and faculty later described in complaints. He belittled female classmates, made misogynistic comments, and questioned disabled students about whether they would even have children. You deaf? You think you should have kids? Are those birthing hips over there? I wish I was making those stories up. I wish the word birthing hips was something that is not now and forever implanted in my mind as a text message that Koberger sent to a woman he went on a Tinder date with. It sounds insane because it is, but it's real. Within weeks, Snyder realized this wasn't going to be a normal semester with his new TA. It was going to be an exhausting one. Other professors and students were dealing with the same pattern. By late fall, the department had logged at least 13 formal complaints against Koberger. He was accused of showing up late to classes run by female professors so often that students kept a tally. He told one woman that she was broken because she was divorced. Broken. Spoken by a late 20-some-year-old Brian Koberger, because he knows what broken's all about. Well, in some ways he does, but it sure as hell ain't a divorced woman. He also argued about, and this is a term he came up with, or maybe it's somewhere else. I don't know. I have never seen it or heard of it before. You tell me your thoughts in the comment section there on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. He argued about sexual burglary in ways that unsettled peers. What does that mean? Does it mean someone who goes in, essays someone while they're burglarizing the house? Female graduate student said he blocked doors in their offices, forcing others to intervene so they could leave. One undergraduate reported that he cornered her so persistently, she had to be escorted home by her boss. Faculty began whispering that if he ever became a professor, he'd end up harassing, stalking, or even essaying the students. Mark my words is a quotation from an email from a professor warning of this. One even pushed to have his funding cut so he'd be removed from the program entirely. It wasn't just rudeness, it was a pattern of control, intimidation, and pettiness that everyone could see, but nobody could stop. People described him as a man who enjoyed conflict, who seemed to thrive on making others uncomfortable. Students noticed too. Early in the semester, one joked in an email to a friend, "My TA looks like a murderer." It was kind of meant as a throwaway line, the kind of gallows humor college students toss around about creepy authority figures. But in hindsight, it kind of lands a little differently. The odd behavior escalated after November 13th of 2022, the night the four University of Idaho students were killed in their home just 20 minutes away from WSU's campus. Koberger came back to class with cuts on his hands. Students noticed bruised knuckles, redness, even a bandaged finger. His demeanor also shifted, disheveled, withdrawn, suddenly avoiding conversations about the case everyone else was discussing. How this did not turn up to be a giant red flag in that class and more people in there didn't start going, huh, maybe it's him? I don't know. I think the first thing, again, I'm not criticizing these students at all. They're young. They're inexperienced at life. Detecting creepy, weird, odd behavior or understanding what to do with it, or even if you do know what to do with it, where does it go from there? But I am honestly a little bit surprised that nobody was going to the administration going, you know, there's those four dead students about 20 miles away and nobody knows who this guy is. My weird kind of uncomfortable TA showed up with cuts on his hand and bruising and doesn't seem to be himself more than he already doesn't seem to be a human. I don't know. Kind of odd. Oh, yeah, he drives the car you're all looking for, too. The timeline, I don't know. I think it would have timed out where his car would have been in there at some point. I am just surprised. Are you surprised by that? Are you surprised that nobody raised a red flag there going, in the odd chance, maybe it's him? I don't know. I am a little. Kind of in the same way, and this is an observational thing, and I'm curious on your thoughts. I mean, in the same way the surviving roommates didn't call 911 immediately. Again, it's not a criticism. It's an observation of, I guess, the path, the mindset that a young person had or has in this situation as to getting troubling, bizarre, disturbing, odd information. You're pulling this into your brain by living the experience. And then not saying anything other than to friends. Obviously, they called 911 eventually, but I'm not criticizing them for doing that. I fully believe it has everything to do with fear, shock, conditioning, and just really different mindset growing up than folks even just a few years older may have. It's a way that we're tethered to these things These things bring us comfort and security more than, I guess, calling the police. And that makes sense. I can understand the psychology of that. But it is bizarre, I guess, by perspective. He apparently stopped bringing his phone to class. A classmate reported him to police after noticing his bloody knuckles and thinking he'd been hitting something. Well, weird. Snyder, he still just seemed irritating. Or to Snyder, it seemed irritating. A wimp more than a threat. That could be another part of this. He does come across kind of as a weird, wimpy, overly pretentious character. May not be one that you saw and thought, oh, he's capable of that. I mean, it's a crazy thought to begin with, to run that through your mind, to actively consider that this person that you're working with on a daily basis for all these months, or that is teaching you that, yes, he's odd, he's weird, he's chauvinistic, but to cross the line of being a quadruple homicide serial killer, that's a bridge. And I can see why it might be a bridge too far for many, just on the sole reason alone, that's a lot to handle. That's a lot for one's brain to take in and say, okay, we'll check that box. That makes sense. Kind of comes back to self-preservation a bit as well. In retrospect, the details of this do align with the reports pouring out of the unsealed interviews. Classmates describing intimidation, professors recounting red flags, students recalling hands that looked injured. Taken together, the picture is haunting. December 30th of 2022, Snyder sat in his nearly empty building when the custodian mentioned police had sealed off the basement. They walked to a picture board of faculty and graduate students speculating whose office was being searched. When the custodian pointed to Koberger's photo, Snyder felt it click. A few minutes later, his phone rang. First, his brother-in-law called, then his son, and the Moscow police themselves, his own TA, the one who wasted his time with nonsense, was in custody for 4 murders. Happy New Year! That was how he spent December 30th. The realization rippled through the department. Other faculty replayed their own encounters, as anyone would. Students came by Snyder's office to check on him. The chair reassigned him a new assistant, one who would make his job easier instead of harder. Can you imagine that? Well, it's hard to follow Brian Koberger, but I'll give it a good old college try. But the damage was already done. Snyder's sense of safety and his sense of purpose, they've been rattled, as it would be for anybody. He dedicated his career to promoting justice, to teaching students how to treat others with fairness and decency. Now he found himself wondering what it meant to work alongside someone who studied criminology not to protect people, but to hurt them. He later learned that police had found a list of women's names in Koberger's possession, including someone Snyder knew from the department. The purpose of that list is still unclear, but to Snyder, it confirmed what he'd felt all semester. This wasn't just an irritating grad student. This was someone who had used his role to push boundaries, to exert control, to probe for weakness. The broader context only deepens that impression. Beyond Snyder's story, the unsealed records show a department on edge. Complaints stacked up, faculty worried about the future. Students traded notes about his creepy comments. Some feared he could become a predator. All the while, he was hiding in plain sight as a teaching assistant, using the role to test how far he could push without consequence. When Snyder reflects on it now, he says what bothers him most isn't that he missed the signs of evil. It's that Koberger chose to use the study of criminology, the same field Snyder taught, with a sense of justice to become a better criminal. Just like Snyder had spent decades helping people caught in bad circumstances, trying to guide them towards decency and fairness, Koberger
he says, dove headfirst into the abyss. That betrayal isn't just personal, it is institutional. Academia brushed off the complaints as personality conflicts. Students joked about him as looking like a murderer. Professors rolled their eyes at his petty arguments. But none of them had the authority to act decisively. And by the time the truth came out, four students were dead. For Snyder, the reality still stings. I thought he was just a wimp, he said. Turns out he was a monster. The story of Brian Koberger as a TA isn't just about one professor's miserable semester. It's about how arrogance, intimidation, and entitlement can look like minor irritations until they're reframed by violence. It's about how people normalize creepy behavior until it's too late. And it's about the uncomfortable truth that sometimes the person wasting your time, following you down the hall, or making your students uneasy isn't just an annoyance. Sometimes it's the red flag nobody wants to take seriously. But what do you do? If I was in his position, I don't know what I would do. I would be filing complaints. I'd be doing everything you can do, but you can't lock him out of the classroom. You can't say, get out of here. This is professor's job. He was assigned this guy. You can't just kick him out. Because what would happen if you take measures like that to the extremes and in your own hands? Well, you could lose your job too. And most people that are strange and odd, well, they don't turn out to be Brian Kohberger's. It may turn out to be many other things, but not usually a Brian Kohberger in terms of level of violence. But what about those lesser ones? I mean, the goalposts are pretty high on a quadruple homicide. But there's a lot of people who aren't going that far. But they're going beyond the lines. They're going beyond the goalposts. They're making it to the concession stand with their extreme behavior. They're going way, way past the goal line. And those are the people we need to be more aware of, because they start somewhere. Koberger started somewhere. He started with petty, smaller things. He didn't go so far right out of the gate. We've learned that. But when he did go out of the gate, he went 0 to 1,000 pretty fast. But what do you do when you see something and you say something and nothing can be done because that person hasn't technically done anything yet that we're all aware of? What's going on in that digital history? What's going on there? Sometimes we could just take a look and answer a lot of questions. Although Koberger dumped his history pretty quick, and you can damn well bet as technology evolves and as people get more and more comfortable with it, I know it sounds weird to say that we're not comfortable with it, but there's still plenty of idiots out there who don't know how to erase a browsing history. Koberger knew how to do that. He knew how to erase the browsing history and then erase the data of the browsing history and any trace of the browsing history. So it was just gone. It wasn't just a, let's delete this. It was, let's wipe this sucker clean. And he did it pretty good for a while until he was caught. And those last few erasure moments didn't happen yet. And we got to see a little chunk of what was going on in that mind of his. Picture Brian Koberger's parents' house in Pennsylvania on the night of December 29th of 2022. Outside, snow on the ground muffles the sound of passing cars, the small town stillness broken only by the occasional gust of wind rattling through bare branches. Inside, the lights glow against the quiet, but there's no real calm in the air. A man who once styled himself as a scholar of criminal minds is pacing, flicking through his phone, his brain racing faster than his body can keep up. The screen's blue light reflects off his face, and if you could see the search terms he was typing into that tiny box, you'd understand just how much fear had taken root. Wiretap. Psychopaths paranoid. These are the search terms of Brian Koberger as police were slowly closing in on him. He isn't reading academic articles anymore. He's trying to figure out if they're listening, if someone can hear him breathe. By that point, the news has been out for weeks. Police want information about a white Hyundai Elantra. He owns one. He knows they're looking. Earlier in the day, he scrolled through the Moscow Police Department's own website, checking for updates, like someone checking the weather before a storm. And then the spiral picks up speed. He clicks into a news story about the car search, scrolls fast, double taps the black button. Then minutes later, he's on the website of an auto detailer. As if a bottle of soap in a vacuum would wash away forensic science. Minutes after that, he's shopping for a new car online. Eyes darting from model to model as if switching vehicles would untangle the web already wrapped around him. His beady little hands, the same hands his classmates had noticed weeks earlier with the bruised knuckles and fresh cuts, are now jittering on the screen, scrolling, searching, refreshing. The house itself feels like it's holding its breath. Upstairs, his parents are asleep, unaware that their son is unraveling under their roof. Downstairs, he's cycling through paranoia in real time. Every keystroke, a confession of fear. He doesn't know that outside, surveillance teams are already in place. They've tracked him across the country, watched him take the long road home, collected trash from the family's garbage bins to confirm his DNA matches. He's Googling wiretaps, but the truth is they don't need to bug his phone. They already have him. This is the image that sticks. The duality of that night. On one screen, a man desperately trying to hold control, convincing himself he's still a step ahead, scrambling for solutions that don't exist. On the other, investigators quietly tightening the circle, checking watches, waiting for the order to move in. And by 1:30 a.m., when officers stormed the house and dragged him out in cuffs, his search history was still fresh. The paranoia still humming like static in the background. And that's where the shadows of Papa Roger account lingers. Because paranoia doesn't stay silent. It spills out into online posts, into combative arguments, in oddly specific details that shouldn't be public. Maybe law enforcement is right. Maybe it wasn't him typing under that name. But when you consider the timeline, the fixation on the sheath, the arrogant arguing that we are now learning about, the final silence just as he was arrested. The similarities feel too sharp to dismiss. And there's a lot of arguments out there. Well, he was posting after that. Prove it. There's a lot of fake names that popped up. There's a lot of fake personas that popped up in the aftermath of him being arrested. And the Papa Roger persona was already under scrutiny. It wouldn't be hard or crazy to think that other fake Papa Rogers popped up, because they did. I saw them myself. Though they said it wasn't him. Yes, and part of the reasoning they said was the IPs didn't make sense. Well, it's called a VPN, kids. In his parents' house that night, Brian Koberger couldn't stop betraying himself. The searches told the story. The fear told the story. And for some, those cryptic posts did too. The man who would eventually be charged with the murders of four University of Idaho students had been presenting himself as a criminology PhD student at Washington State University. In class, he was combative and condescending, the type of person who couldn't let criticism slide. 13 complaints had just been filed against him in just a few months. Students and professors reporting sexist, belittling remarks, intimidation, even being cornered in offices. He'd been written up for telling a deaf classmate she shouldn't procreate, for dismissing a divorced woman as broken, and for showing up late to female professors' classes with such consistency that students started keeping a tally. Faculty said he was petty, argumentative, and obsessed with proving He was the smartest voice in the room. Kind of like Papa Roger did before he got kicked out of other groups, before he had to create his own that was safe for him to comment under, if he did that. That pattern of behavior in inability to resist conflict and a craving for validation lines up uncomfortably well with what people saw from the Papa Roger account. Always arguing, always pushing, needing to be the center of attention in a storm of speculation. That and, oh, the profile picture looks exactly like Brian Koberger before anybody knew who Brian Koberger was. So there's that. Authorities now insist it wasn't him. I insist you didn't dig deep enough. They say that they did a deep dive, checked against digital trails, IP addresses, and found no connection. Well, tell me how you did that. Moscow PD. I'm not questioning your investigation. I'm just questioning where your conclusions stopped. That's the official story. But if you believe that answer ties everything up neatly, you're missing how paranoia leaks out in ways people don't always expect. Koberger may have been clever, but he wasn't untouchable. This is a man who understood technology well enough to swap his phone on and off during surveillance, to go dark at key moments when police later tracked his movements. Are we really supposed to think that he couldn't have masked his IP with a VPN while posting online? That's going to be the answer to the story. Well, IP didn't match. That means nothing. Technical barriers were not his downfall. It might be the downfall of Moscow PD. And you may want to dig a little deeper or get a little more in depth with your investigative skills. Hopefully you don't have to use them like this again, but hey, they're good to have. And the sheath, this is where the details and the denials really lose a lot of weight. It's not logical to guess that a killer not only used a fixed blade, but also left the sheath behind at the scene when nobody knew about it. That's not the kind of thing you just toss out casually in a chat thread. Guessing the weapon was one thing. Guessing the blunder that tied him to the crime forever is another. That detail mattered because it wasn't just speculation. It became the central piece of the evidence. His DNA was on it. It's the reason his name even rose to the top of the suspect list. So when an anonymous account drops it weeks before the affidavit goes public, an account that profile looks just like the killer, it doesn't read like foresight. It reads like leakage. Meanwhile, Koberger himself was unraveling in real time. Investigators now say that on the night of December 29th, just hours before he was arrested, he went on a string of frantic internet searches, looking up wiretap, typed in psychopaths paranoid. Psychopaths paranoid. He's defining himself as a psychopath, so desperately trying to fit in with some club. What do psychopaths do when they're paranoid? Let me see what the other psychopaths do when they're paranoid so I can do it too. This is literally how his brain is working. He clicked through to the Moscow Police Department's own website. He read news about police seeking information on the white Hyundai Elantra, the same model he owned, the same car, caught on surveillance multiple times around the crime scene. Same one that got stopped twice on the way to mom and dad's. He didn't stop there. Minutes later, he was looking into an auto detailing service. 10 minutes after that, he was browsing for new cars online, eyes darting from model to model as if switching vehicles would untangle the web already wrapped around him. It's a window into a man in full spiral. He knew the car was on a weak point for him, the thread that could unravel everything. He obsessed over it, and his phone record and recorded the paranoia blow by blow. And what's a red herring, as according to Papa Roger, that isn't anything to pay attention to? A Hyundai Elantra. If you put yourself in that house in Pennsylvania on the night of December 29th, you can almost feel the air thick with dread. He's back in his childhood home, surrounded by the walls that watched him grow up. But instead of safety, he's staring at a glowing screen, refreshing police updates, realizing every detail points straight to him. He thinks maybe he can wash it away with car soap. Maybe he can buy something new and disappear into traffic. But it's too late. The sheath with his DNA was already in evidence. Surveillance teams were already outside. And when police kicked down the door in the early hours of December 30th, they weren't guessing. They knew. This is where the Papa Roger account loops back into the story, because even if we accept the official claim that it was not Koberger, the behavior still mirrors his own unraveling. The account stopped posting the very night he was arrested. Some will argue that. Well, then prove it wrong. I'm very open to seeing it being proven wrong from the same places, because there was a lot of fake ones that did pop up. And it ain't hard for people to go, well, see, he's right there. Yeah, I can do a picture too, and I can create another profile just like that. Is it the same account? We don't have that information. All traits Koberger's classmates and professors had flagged repeatedly were on full display. He was described as enjoying conflict, unable to back down from a debate, desperate to prove his intellectual superiority. The Facebook posts and the WSU complaints read like two sides of the same personality. Combative in person, combative online. Authorities may prefer a tidy narrative that the suspect was isolated, caught by forensics and old-fashioned detective work. And yes, the DNA on the sheath was the smoking gun. But when you look at the totality of his behavior, the late-night Google spirals, the paranoia about wiretaps, the frantic attempts to wash away evidence, and the way an anonymous online voice seemed to know too much, you get a portrait of a man who couldn't stop himself from leaking fear into the world. The Gonzalez, Mogan, Chapin, and Kernodle families don't need speculation about online aliases. They have the reality of loss that will never be filled. And for those trying to understand who Brian Koberger was in those weeks between November 13th and December 30th, the paranoia is the through line. In Pullman, his classmates noticed the shift. Bloodied knuckles, bulky jackets, comments that the killer must have been pretty good. It's a weird thing for someone to say, Papa Roger. Online, someone calling themselves Papa Roger argued about fixed blades and red herrings. And on his phone, the search history betrays him in his own words. Wiretap, paranoid, car detailers, new cars. This is a man spiraling under the weight of his own crime. In July of 25, he stood in Boise in that courtroom and admitted guilt. No motive was revealed, no explanations offered. He declined to speak at the sentencing. Even his families wept a few feet away. Four consecutive life sentences plus 10 years. Guaranteed he'll die behind bars. Probably sooner than later. No parole, no second act, no audience left to impress. But the questions of Papa Roger linger. Not because it changes the outcome, but because it fits a pattern too neatly to ignore. Paranoia rarely hides quietly. It scratches at the edges. It spills into internet searches, awkward classroom comments, cryptic posts in online groups. Maybe authorities are right. Maybe it really wasn't him behind those posts. But if it wasn't, then what we're left with is still a story of a man who couldn't stop telegraphing his unraveling through his hands, through his arguments, through his compulsive need to be noticed. The takeaway isn't just about one account or one denial. It's about the way killers reveal themselves even when they think they're hidden. Koberger believed he was smarter than the cops, smarter than his peers, smarter than the world. But arrogance has cracks, and through those cracks, paranoia dripped out. In words, in searches, in scars on his skin. That paranoia didn't save him, it exposed him. And in the end, it told the story almost as loudly as the evidence did. And you have to ask yourself this question, too. If Papa Roger was not Koberger, then who was it? And who knew that kind of information? It was not the general public. Maybe the police? You'd think they would have come out and said that by now, though. It was us. We were trying to lure him in. Just because your IP address doesn't point to a name that says Brian Koberger in big flashy lights doesn't mean it was not him. And maybe we will just never know. Because that's the point of VPNs. That's the point of secrecy. It's kind of a door that leads to a cliff. And you walk off that cliff, You don't know where you're going to land. And he knew that. And he was hiding in his anonymity, the same way he was hiding his searches, the same way he was hiding his digital trail. He was hiding then, too. Until everything imploded on that late December night.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
As if Koberger's first two complaints weren't revealing enough, the harassment note and the mush on the tray saga, we then get his third letter. And this one takes the cake, or rather, doesn't take the cake, because Brian Koberger's problem was that items on his tray were missing. And he wanted replacements per policy. He literally cited nutrition standards like he was arguing a thesis. He positioned himself not as an inmate, but as an aggrieved customer demanding better service. If it weren't attached to the brutal reality of who he is, it would almost be a parody. The prison's response was blunt, almost dismissive. Disruptions like flooding happen, but J2 is generally calm, and B block wouldn't be any better. That to his other complaint about being picked on, people calling names, water being flooded into his cell. And there was no response to the snacks. It's just the submission. So basically, sit down, shut up, and get used to it. But what fascinates me about this is what it says about his long game, or rather, his total lack of game. Koberger thought he'd be infamous yet, but infamous in a way that still held some twisted prestige. He imagined professors studying him, maybe even profiling him. It's being next to Bundy or BTK. What he's realizing now is that he doesn't have the charisma, the intelligence, or the social savvy of those killers. Horrible as they were, used to avoid detection, he's just as a husk facade, as Robin described, a movie set with nothing behind the walls. And that's what makes this so important. Because the letters don't just show a man whining about food. They show someone who still hasn't accepted reality, who still believes he can manipulate the system with words and formality. They reveal a mind of a psychopath who underestimated everyone and now finds himself out of moves. Robin Drake with us, former FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. When you look at these three letters together, the harassment complaint, the food grievance, the transfer request, what do they tell you about where Koberger is heading mentally? You know, is this someone spiraling deeper into frustration, or someone who still believes he can talk his way into a better outcome? Let's get into it. And here's another complaint letter. This is the third one that we've seen now of Brian Koberger. Let's take a look at it. This one, and this is a harder one to read.
Yeah, but I like the response.
Yeah. As I continue the SPI phase, I love the terminology phase. Like, this is, it's just a step on your journey, Brian. Mm-hmm. I wish to discuss if I may be transferred to another ad seg, so another setting in the jail, in the B block. I'm going to try and read it this way because it's hard to see where they're not engaging any of the recent flooding striking. So that's, he's talking about people are flooding his cell by letting their water drip down, which is lovely. And being subject to minute by minute verbal threats and harassment in his unit. It's hard to read his writing. So basically he's asking if he could be moved to another block.
Right.
And immediately, I wish to speak with you soon, is how he ends it. The response is legible. Mr. Koberger, on any tier at MSI, there are sometimes disruptions to operations, such as residents flooding the J2 in a
it's relatively rare occurrence, and J2 is genuinely a fairly calm, quieter tier. I do not think B-Block would be any better for you. Give it some time.
How do you think he's reacting to all of this and this reality?
Well, he's trying to escape.
Yeah.
He can't. He thinks the grass is going to be greener someplace else. Nope.
No.
He hasn't accepted the now.
Yeah.
And he's being destroyed. And it's not going to get better. He's going to be, until he accepts that, he's going to keep in the struggle. And it'll be really interesting because he's as we've seen, he's very OCD. He's very, mm-hmm. you know, intense on his way of liking to do things. And people keep disrupting it every single day. I've never in my entire life have I smiled at someone's misfortune or someone's discomfort. And I think we all are collectively together enjoying every minute of this horrendous shell of a human being tortured.
Yeah.
And I feel so horrendous as a human being on this planet thinking that, but mm-hmm. this is the only time in my entire life, and hopefully it will be the only one ever, because he so deserves everything he's getting right now. I'm so glad for it.
It really is. I mean, yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. I'm like, this is insane that, like, I feel like joyful when I see these and I'm laughing, but it's like, well, he deserves it. I mean, the lack of humility, the lack of anything in this monster, it's like, well, that's the only way you can respond to monsters is by being a monster.
100% predictable.
Yeah.
You knew this was going to happen because of that arc of who he is.
Yeah.
And you hit it really well for everyone, you know, listening and watching us. I have, again, not a licensed clinician, and he hasn't been diagnosed with this, but if anyone's ever looking and wondering what a pure psychopath looks like, mm-hmm. as we keep saying how empty he is, this is it.
Yeah.
This is the most extreme I've ever seen, because if you want to study him, don't study him. Study everyone he's studying, and then you'll understand him better.
Yeah.
Seriously, because that's the only thing you can do, because he is nothing without anyone else.
Yeah. I mean, and it's stunning just how monstrous this man can be. There was some warning signs, but at the end of the day, I don't fault anybody in any of their positions. What are you going to do? You can't do anything. I mean, there was the one professor who was writing to other professors saying, mark my words, literally, yes. Mark my words. If we give this guy a doctoral, if we give this guy what he wants, he will end up being an SA-er, and he will be. And look what happened. Obviously, that didn't quite happen. It got even worse. He murdered people, probably with the intent to do that. But what do you do? What do you do in a world where people like this exist? I mean, I've been in meetings with people. I've had people, I've had employees, I've had all different stuff where you look back and go, yeah, that person's probably going to do this, you know, at some point in time. But without them doing anything, you can't do anything about it. You can't turn them in. We just wait. We just wait for them to strike, no matter how dark and disturbing it is or how dark and disturbing their actions are. If they're not crossing the line to illegal activity, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're so right. I had a few situations where we had a company or an individual's report on someone else having very similar behavior to this. Mm-hmm. And they came to us saying, hey, you need to do something, FBI. And I'm like, dude, tell me the law he broke.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't break a law, but here's all the red signs. They said, all I can do is this, fire him.
Yeah.
And don't hire him.
Yeah.
I don't care what it is. And then all you can do is let the family know, here's what we're seeing. You got a problem and you better fix it, or get them counseling, get in something else, because legally there's zero you can do.
Yeah. Well, and legally,
all you can do is try to isolate them away from other people by not allowing in companies, it's not a shame on, because, you know, I get it, you know, universities, you know, but he should never have been allowed in that PhD program. Because one reason why all these higher things we do in life require recommendations and interviews is for this purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard. The hardest thing I used to have to do in the FBI was on a piece of paper, I had to articulate human behavior in order to get approval to do things.
Mm-hmm.
I got very adept at being able to state, hey, here's what I was able to achieve from going from point A to point B on someone's life arc of development, because during this discussion, we were able to discuss X, Y, and Z. This was part of my objective to get this kind of deeper conversation going, to get access to X, Y, and Z. And so I could articulate the developmental process of the emotional connection we were trying to make to move down a path of recruiting.
Sure.
That took a long time to try to figure out, how am I going to objectively, cognitively talk about human behavior, either good or bad, to get a dial moved with someone on a check, it's got a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. It's very challenging. So it's, I don't fault anyone for it, but I had to do it for a long period of time and then try to train other people to objectively observe human behavior so you could actually see red flags and make decisions that are, that can sound very subjective because it's an opinion. It's that art form of taking subjective opinion and making it objectable actions when you're dealing with human behavior. Very challenging. So that's why I don't fault them, but this is why you have to put these things in place.
I don't think
don't
a lot of
hire people yeah. like this.
I don't think a lot of people see it, honestly. I mean, there's certain people that are aware. I mean, I know you and me would see. There's a lot of people that would and go, there's something wrong. There's something off here. Maybe I can't put my finger on it, but not the type of person I want. But I don't know that a lot of people are able to identify it. But even beyond that, even if you do identify it, don't hire the person to begin with. If they're already there, you know, it is easy to say, well, let's get rid of them. But there's so many protections out there for folks that are off, that, I mean, if you fire them for being off but never committing a crime, you're liable. You're firing someone because of their personality, but if it's not affecting the job, and that's the weird road that we go down in these sort of things with people like this.
And that's why it's really important at the onset of things. So we had a category, I don't remember what it is now. You know, when I was in the Marine Corps, you had a category of your evaluation called professionalism. Mm-hmm. And part of professionalism was your weight, your uniform, your haircut, your scores on the physical fitness test. I mean, there's a lot of very... So professionalism can be a subjective word, but when actually made it actionable and objective by these measures, mm-hmm. it could be scored. It could be measured. And so anytime that I had to counsel someone on something, like one of my Marines, this goes way back when for me, I actually had to articulate, all right, here's the standard on at GO. The standard is you must maintain a professional relationship with your recruits, with other drill instructors, with officers and all these things. And so what would happen is if I saw behavior that could be subjectively deemed inappropriate, say I heard someone making a comment, mm-hmm. an inappropriate comment towards another drill instructor, male or female, my job was then to, hey, Staff Sergeant, come over here. Here's what I observed. And I write down this. This is an unacceptable behavior of that comment that I observed you making firsthand, not hearsay. And I'm deeming this unprofessional. I'm writing it down on this piece of paper. I need you to sign this as well. And you acknowledge that this is unacceptable behavior for professionalism when regarding other Marines. Now, here's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. I have identified this. You now know the behavior to avoid. If I don't see this behavior again in the next 4 weeks, I'm going to hand you this paper back and it's all yours. No harm, no foul. Now, if I do see a behavior that mirrors or is exactly like that, where it's going to be a different conversation, now we're going to talk about moving you out and moving you on. Mm-hmm. So this is how leadership has to take the energy and bandwidth to articulate behaviors that are red flags, mm-hmm. address them according to a standard that's been set at the very beginning, and not be afraid. And it's not confrontational. Conversations. It's a conversation about their behavior and how their behavior is incongruent with the standard that we set. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that early on, you get into problems like this.
Yeah. Seems like we used to have a lot more of that going on where standards.
It takes courage.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes courage. It takes having standards. And I don't know if it's just lack of standards or what it is, or lack of reps in people, you know, facing icky situations that make them uncomfortable. Where the leadership, look, if you're in leadership, you're going to be in uncomfortable situations. That's why you're the leader. It's part of the job. But I feel so many times we see leaders that, you know, they, and you want to lead by example. You don't necessarily need to lead by fear, but sometimes if you have someone out there that's this out there that you're literally saying, I think he's going to SA somebody,
I would think there's some actionable options that might be on the table for you. It looks like they were, obviously they did explore it. They did get rid of him. So things did take place. Things did go down, but he was able to go down a path for quite a while. I mean, everybody could see it. His parents, you know, could see he was off. His friends saw it. I mean, this guy just, he was a little tornado that went through life and was able to go as far as he did. And there's, I don't know, there feels like there's so many folks out there like this that just seem like they're one step away from being a Koberger. Thankfully, we don't see it that frequently, but we, I feel like we live in a world where there's so much protection on not offending someone for their behavior, for their choices, that it's just kind of a free for all in so many ways. And people don't necessarily end up killing, you know, others, but they make life a living hell for others who are just trying to do their jobs and get through life. And we don't do a whole lot to kick them to the curb and go, just go figure something else out that's more in your wheelhouse, because this is not.
Yeah, you know, and I think the challenge that people will have with this, because again, I'm going to give the people around him a lot of credit for being very kind people. Yeah. They were very kind to him. And because the reason why this is a challenge is because people think these are challenging conversations, or I'm going to be an ass, or I'm going to have to be the hammer. No. All you're doing is making observations on their behavior.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is letting this, because this is how we have behavior conversations. Because if you're given an opinion, here's the difference, Tony. Mm-hmm. Koberger, I think what you said is inappropriate. That's an opinion. Mm-hmm. We can argue back and forth, as opposed to Koberger, here's the behavior you just said. Here's what you just did. Here's how that is incongruent with what the standard is. Here's what the effect this statement had on the people around you, and that is not professional in the workplace. And so here's your choice. Here's your choices. You can stop that behavior now, and it'll be written off, and we'll keep a file over here. Or if you continue that behavior, here's the consequence of this. It's completely up to you.
Yeah.
This is not my opinion. This is your behavior and the cause and effect of what you're doing according to this standard that's been set down by the university.
Yeah. You're eliminating the other human aspect that they can argue with and say,
there's no argue.
That's your opinion. Like, it's not my opinion. This is how this is deviating.
Yes.
And it's black and white.
This is how.
Yeah.
And I apologize, because that's how I had to learn how to have behavior conversations where it wasn't an opinion. Mm-hmm. It's an observation. And when observations are observed by multiple people and they have an effect on those individuals, well, that becomes a trend. That becomes an arc of your behavior and the impact on others. And so now it just comes down to that is incongruent with what we expect in this workplace. You can make a choice about what you want to do about it. And I'm here to tell you the cause and effect of your choices.
Mm-hmm. And that's the paradox of Brian Koberger in prison. For all his formal writing, for all his attempts to couch his complaints in the language of rules and regulations, the system isn't listening. It's logging, stamping, and moving on. Meanwhile, the inmates are reading him like a book and tormenting him for sport. Good job, guys. Robin's breakdown reminds us that Koberger isn't the brilliant mastermind some wanted to paint him as. He's a profoundly empty figure. His entire persona is a collage of traits borrowed from others, cobbled together from textbooks, documentaries, and case studies. But the substance, the inner life, the ability to adapt and survive, it isn't there. He's hollow. And prison is exposing that hollowness in ways that no courtroom ever could. What's most unsettling is how many people saw pieces of this long before he ever killed. Professors warned about his instability. Students picked up on his arrogance and lack of social awareness. Friends, family, everyone had glimpses of the tornado forming. But without an actual crime to act on, those red flags never translated into an intervention. And so here we are, dissecting his complaints about cafeteria trays, while four young people are still gone forever. Maybe that's why there's a strange satisfaction in watching him flail. It doesn't erase the grief, and it doesn't bring justice
in the truest sense. But it does strip away the myth of his intelligence, the illusion of his superiority, and it reminds us that in the end, Brian Koberger is not a case study in brilliance. He's a case study in failure. Failure to adapt, failure to manipulate, failure to become anything more than what he is, a mass murderer with no power, no credibility, and no way out. And that's the final note here. Koberger thought prison would be his laboratory, his stage, his twisted continuation of the academic life he lost. Instead, it's his undoing. The letters will keep coming and we'll keep reading them. The complaints will pile up and the torment from inmates will only grow louder. But nothing will change. He is and always will be just another prisoner, stripped of the very control he once killed to prove he had. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You can also search us wherever you get podcasts and find us there as well. Press subscribe, please, so you don't miss any of our coverage in this and the many cases we follow for you here at the Hidden Killers podcast from True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.